Beginning with House Bill 2363, proceeding to 2364, 2365, 2366, 2367, and 2368. And would council please read the summary on the first one, House Bill 2363. House Bill 2363 relates to notice in adult protective proceedings and restores the applicability of notice requirements to adult protective proceedings that were inadvertently deleted during the 99 legislative session. Also clarifies that the notice requirements for adult guardianships added during the 99 session are in addition to rather than in place of the pre-existing notice requirements. Thank you, Council. We have Jennifer Wright. Would you please come forward? Ryan Gibb, did you want to come up with us? Okay, good. All right.
Some of these they may want to vote, but I'm all together because it's the same people are going to be talking about.
Just a moment. This is Elder Law Day, and it looks like we have pretty much the same witnesses on all of these. Excuse me, with the exception of two, we have an additional witness. And we will move through these. You do not have to leave. Thank you, Mayor. And we will proceed to have you take your testimony on House Bill 2363.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Jennifer Wright. I am co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar Association. Our section is comprised of about 450 attorneys at latest count who have come from all areas of the state and who specializes in legal problems facing the elderly in our state. Many members of the section have been active participants in over many years in efforts to reform and improve ORS Chapter 125, which is the Oregon Protective Proceedings Statute. I've provided my written testimony. I don't know that you've had a chance to read it. I don't have a great deal to add to that, but just sort of to put it in a nutshell, in the last revision and last session, we wished very much to add specifically for adults who are in guardianship proceedings because they're alleged to be incapacitated. So this does not affect the juveniles. That they should receive an additional form of notice and that it should be made more easy for them to express any objections they might have. And to that end, the legislature passed a bill that created a statutory form for notice and for expressing objections. The intention of all parties at the time was that this was to be an additional notice provided to adult respondents because of the particular concerns about protecting their rights. Unfortunately, as the bill was worded and it was not caught, what the bill did was it removed the existing requirements for notice for adults in conservatorship and guardianship, and this was unfortunate because the new form did not include all of the elements of the traditional notice. Under the current statute, the traditional notice is only required for minors in guardianship, and the only notice required for adults is the statutory form. It was an oversight. I think that my contact with members of our section is that best practice continues to be, and many courts still adamantly require that both forms of notice be provided to adults in guardianship. However, it is not, certainly somebody coming to the statute and reading it could not understand that that was what the expectation and requirement is. We're simply making a very small change to put the statute back to where we had intended it to be.
Thank you. I don't have any questions.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Wright.
Oh.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I think that was my bill last session.
I think it was.
I think so. But I'm not sure. Was it really an oversight? You have the basic notice requirements in sub 1, and then sub 2 says if it's a minor, we do this, And then sub three, instead of just saying what has to be said, sub three actually then prescribes the form if you've got a petition in the case of an incapacitated person. I don't have any problem with if we need to beef up the notice to incapacitated people, but I guess one thing I would have a concern about, if all we do is take out that language, who is a minor, on line 13, then essentially we're requiring, it seems like duplicate information, because some of what sub 2 says you have to provide is actually provided in the form of notice in sub 3. And so I'm not sure if we require both what's in sub 2 and what's in sub 3, if we're not confusing the notice, because you're getting some parts of the notice or the information twice. Because again, sub 2 says you have to provide this, and then sub 3 actually has most of it, I would guess, in the form itself.
Madam Chair and Representative Shetterly, it is correct that there is some overlap between the two. The sub two, however, does not require any form of
right.
words. It can be done in any way. So to the information that is required in sub two that is already in the form does not need to be provided again. But there is additional information in sub two which is not part of the form. And one of the specifically very important ones is information about low cost or free legal and other services available to respondents in guardianship that are available in their local area. It can't be made part of a statewide form because it's going to be different for each community. But it is important information that by local rule is often specified and that we think is very important for adults in guardianship to have access to that information.
Madam Chair?
Representative Shetterly?
Well, I'm just wondering then if it wouldn't be better if we were going to require the information in sub 2 to be provided in all cases, wouldn't it be better then to at least delete from sub 2 those aspects of information that are actually covered in the notice so that it doesn't appear to be duplicating information that has to be provided? For instance, the right to file a written or oral objection, that's covered in the notice. The right to request a hearing, be represented by an attorney, those things are all covered in the notice. So it seems to me that if we're going to make 2 and 3 apply in all cases, then we really ought to do a better job of merging them so we don't have the overlap between them.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Representative Shetterly, the problem is that the notice is not required to minor respondents. And the information that is provided in sub 2 is important information to be provided to minor respondents who will not get the statutory form. I think there is a concern generally that perhaps the way we have merged and drawn up the process, that more attention should be paid to the distinction between minor and adult respondents. And I have talked, our section has talked to members of the juvenile section about in a future session trying to work out some of those confusions a little bit more clearly. But I do think there's a risk if the requirements of sub 2 are changed, then there will be an effect on juvenile respondents that our section wouldn't notice, but others certainly would. It would have an impact.
Another question? Ms. Wright?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, Mr. Yip?
Ryan. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I'll simply defer to.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. The hearing is closed and go to work session discussion.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I appreciate what we're getting after here. I'd like some time to work with this bill. I think that the little fix may not be enough.
And the notice portion that you were asking this.
Yeah,
about.
Like I say, I'm. I think as long as we're looking at this, if there is a way to make it clearer to distinguish between juvenile and guardianships and guardianships of incapacitated people, adults. I think the approach of LC here by just deleting those four words on line 13 might not get us to where the proponents want to go. I'm certainly supportive of this, but I think we could do it better if we spend a little bit more time with it, and I'd be happy to work with council and with the proponents.
Okay. Do you have an idea of time, Mr. Shetterly?
Oh, 2 o'clock today.
2 o'clock today?
Yeah, that'd be done.
Well, that's fast.
Yeah. a week to 10 days, I think we could get that done.
All right. What we'll do is we will reopen this session when Representative Shetterly has the opportunity to review this and reschedule it for at least a week. Okay, a week to 10 days before we can get it back on the agenda.
For instance, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If there are things that are appropriate in proceedings for minors that may not be necessary in guardianships for incapacitated people or vice versa, we could say that if the notice requirements in sub 2 are sufficient for minor proceedings, then maybe we can take some of those things in sub 2 and add them to the form that's required in adult guardianships and cover the gaps that way. Anyway, I'll work with them.
Okay. Thank you.
Take that one. Hearing on House Bill 2364. Council, read the summary, please.
The bill permits Medicaid payment of costs and fees associated with guardianship where the guardianship is necessary to authorize needed medical treatment for long-term care recipients. It allows the payment to be made either out of the Medicaid funds or by allowing the recipient to deduct the payment for such expenses before determining his or her contribution toward the cost of such care. Thank you.
Jennifer Wright.
Excuse me, Chair. Just so that the committee knows, there is a fiscal statement on 2364, and in addition, you should have in your packet two sets of amendments, the dash one and the dash two.
Oh, that's on 2365.
I have the amendment.
Well, actually, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you're right. I don't have one. I'm not sure what's going on. I'll figure that out.
It's 2365. It has a fiscal, right?
Right. I think there is one for 2364, but we haven't received it yet. That's right. That's the one that we haven't received yet. But if we were to pass this bill out of this committee, it would have to go to Ways and Means. But you do have one?
We have one. Yes.
I thought you did.
One was passed down to me, so I now have one. Everyone has the fiscal statement?
Hey, Ms. Wright and Mr. Gibb.
Okay, you may begin.
Madam Chair, we do have two other members of our legislative committee who have taken the lead on this bill that just signed in. Simon has a sprained ankle and got here late. So I would like to defer initially to them, if I may.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair and council members, my name is Ryan Gibb. I'm an elder law attorney here in Salem in private practice. The majority of my practice focuses on elder law, and this is an issue which I have seen in my own practice and see in the legal community. The issue that we're dealing with primarily, and I've submitted written testimony which covers the issue, I believe, thoroughly, but I would like to address some highlights and answer any questions. The issue that this bill is designed to deal with are the situations where an individual is qualified or is already receiving Medicaid benefits from the state of Oregon. In those circumstances, generally that person is receiving less than $1,590 a month in income, and they have less than $2,000 in assets which they are able to use to pay for their care or their expenses. Medicaid rules require that they use their income to pay for the cost of care, which is a reasonable use of their income. Unfortunately, there come times for these individuals when they're not able to consent to medical treatment which they need. In those circumstances, a guardian is needed for them in order to consent to the necessary medical treatment. Because of their financial situation, oftentimes there are not funds available to cover the costs of either the establishment of a guardianship, including court filing fees, attorney fees, court visitor fees, and also to cover the costs of a professional guardian when that is needed, if there's not a family member or another individual able to do that. These costs can easily run upwards of $2,000 or more, even in a non-contested guardianship case. Without the ability to use their income and with the reality that they have limited funds in order to pay that, they may not be able to obtain this guardianship. There may not be the ability to pay for the guardianship, and so these people may go without the necessary medical treatment because there is no one to consent to that treatment for them. House Bill 2364 addresses this problem by allowing the Medicaid recipient to use $200 or 25% of their gross monthly income to help to offset those costs, either entirely in the first month or over a series of months to pay off the entire guardianship costs and to pay for the ongoing guardianship expenses. This is a reasonable approach to the problem for a couple of reasons. First of all, the Medicaid rules for the state of Oregon allow, if an individual has more than $1,590 in gross monthly income, they can establish an income cap trust and still qualify for Medicaid benefits, even though they don't fit within the Medicaid guidelines, Medicaid income limits. The state of Oregon has amended the rules regarding the income cap trust to allow for guardianship expenses as well as other expenses to be paid from the income cap trust. That payment offsets or reduces the amount of that individual's income which is paid towards the cost of their care in any given month. This creates a disparity then between people who have greater than $1,590 per month in income and those who have less, treating them differently and meaning that some folks would be able to receive the necessary medical treatment because a guardianship may be established and others cannot. That is a primary concern and I think is something that may not affect a great number of Oregonians, but those who it does affect, it affects in a very serious way. I think House Bill 2364 is an appropriate way to deal with this problem to assure that funds are available to pay for the expenses of the establishment of the guardianship as well as the ongoing expenses of the guardianship itself. There has been an objection presented to the elder law section from the State of Oregon Senior Disabled Services Division based on the fiscal impact. I believe that there is not a large target audience to this bill because of the limited focus of who would be entitled to utilize their income to pay for the guardianship. It is only those individuals for whom a guardianship petition would be filed on or after the effective date of the bill and who are receiving Medicaid benefits. In my own practice, I see that to be a relatively small number of people. I don't know exactly. I have not had the benefit of looking at the detailed fiscal impact statement. There was an amendment that was faxed in, I believe, yesterday to the committee. I'm not sure if that has made it through legislative council. Okay, I apologize. It has. The last paragraph of my testimony deals with an issue brought up by the Oregon Medical Association dealing with the language that was used in the bill, calling it expenses for medically necessary guardianship. That language has been amended, and I believe that you have that in front of you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Panel, have any questions? Dr. Kidd? Representative Ringo.
Hey, good morning. What does it typically cost in terms of attorney fees for a guardianship?
Madam Chair and Representative Ringo, attorney fees can generally run anywhere from the neighborhood of $500 to $1,000, which covers basic filing, which covers notices, which covers a wide variety of documentation and paperwork that has to be filed with the court. In most counties, the filing fee for the guardianship is $65. In Multnomah County, it's been increased to about $400 to cover their pilot project up there. There are also court visitor fees, which generally range in the neighborhood of $250 up to $500, depending on the complexity of the case. And if a professional guardian is needed, there's generally a flurry of activity in the first month or two, and professional guardians generally charge in the neighborhood of $60 to $75 an hour. So it's not uncommon in the Multnomah County area for a basic guardianship to run in the neighborhood of $1,500 to $2,000, even without being contested.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
I'm wondering whether there's any room for abuse with regard to those fees, in that to the extent the person is not paying them directly, but they come out of the monthly amount that they may not see, whether that is incentive for the attorney to charge more than otherwise might be charged. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Madam Chair and Representative Ringo, there is in all guardianship and in all protective proceeding cases the requirement that the fees be approved by the court before those are paid. That provides a certain level of review for those. There isn't necessarily a process for the State of Oregon to review those or Senior Disabled Services to review those outside of receiving or having the possibility to receive notice of those through the court process. So there's not, beyond judicial review, there is not a review of those fees.
I guess that currently the same situation occurs. You might have that abuse if the clients have more than $1,590 in income, correct?
With the income cap trust, any diversion away from the patient liability or the patient payment is approved by the caseworker for the Medicaid office. So there is local caseworker review of any changes when it comes to that income cap trust for those who receive more than $1,590 in income. It is a possibility that policy could be enacted that a caseworker would have some input as to how much of the attorney fees are paid, or state policy could be enacted setting a limit on the actual amount which is paid. That's not something that's been addressed.
I mean, the four of you folks, has anybody considered this, whether there's a potential abuse for attorney fees, or is it just considered not likely to be a problem?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo.
Please state your name.
My name is Dady Catherine Blake. I am an elder law attorney as well in the Portland area. In any situation involving a guardianship or conservatorship, the fees are usually paid from the protected person, that is the person who's under the guardian or conservator. And there is always the possibility, since they're not, someone else is sort of paying out of their funds. And that is why we have in the probate process throughout the state a review of all fees. They must be reasonable for the services rendered. And I can speak personally for Multnomah County that she is a very, our probate judge, Judge Welsh, is a very proactive judge. She will balance those fees out. I do not think as well that it would be very different from how we interact with the state regarding SDSD issues, that some type of either formal or informal policy was agreed to. We have a very good relationship with the people at Human Health Services. This committee does. In particular, we have a subcommittee that works with them actively and works on policy issues. So I could see that setting some type of reasonable range that they would agree to and that we would understand and inform our members of could very easily happen. One other point I'd like to make on fiscal impact. In my practice in Multnomah County, I see quite a few poor families who can't afford to do this. The parent may not be on Medicaid at that time. And when I tell them how much it costs, normal fees, court costs now in Multnomah County very high, plus court visitor costs is a flat fee of $450. You know, we're talking a couple thousand dollars that they're looking at right up front. They are becoming increasingly discouraged, and I do waive my fees a lot, but they will go to the commitment process. If you're familiar with the commitment process, they can get the same type of court-ordered care for a parent. In this case, the state is paying all costs, all attorney costs on both sides. They send out people. The judge and the whole assembly, court assembly, usually show up at the hospital. It is an extremely expensive process for which the state bears the entire burden. So this is one of the alternatives that we face by not having a mechanism by which the person's income can pay. Families are forced to go this way because they don't want to get stuck paying it. They don't have the funds usually. So thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe. I guess I have a procedural bill. I only have one page to this bill, but it doesn't, the sentence at the bottom of the page at line 31 doesn't end in a period. I'm wondering if we're missing part of the bill.
Come back.
Oh.
Never mind.
Next question, may I?
Yes, you may.
I noticed that the direction in which the withheld money is contemplated under this bill, there is not a priority list for which expenses get paid first. What's your thinking there, please? Ryan can, or either one, I don't care.
Normally, the way things must be paid in Multnomah County, the court fees would be a priority and the court visitor fees. Before anything happens, that usually has to be paid first.
I'm pretty well aware of that, but I just wanted it on the record.
I don't have any additional comment to that.
Madam Chair?
Representative Shirley.
It just raises the question, in the dash 2 amendments on line 6, we're referring to the cost, guardianship costs, court costs, and attorney fees. Do you contemplate guardianship costs to include visitors' fees? Is that what, do you have that in mind there?
Madam Chair, Representative Shirley, yes, the term guardianship costs would contemplate filing fees, court visitor fees, professional guardian fees.
Any other questions of the panel?
Just one personal question. Are we on the Internet? Are we on the Internet? Are we on the Internet?
Probably count on it.
If we are?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Never mind.
Did Ruth Simons wish to testify?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Ruth Simons, and I'm an elder law attorney in the Portland area, and I wish to make a point regarding the fiscal impact, because I understand from speaking extensively with SDSD that they are projecting a significant impact there. And what I wanted to clarify was part of the process they went through in obtaining that impact was an analysis of Multnomah County and the percentage of clients that were on Medicaid and had guardianships, and then that percentage then allocated to the rest of the state. And what I wanted to clarify is that currently, from what I understand, last year, SDSC provided 50 contracts to special attorneys who are contracted for the purpose of establishing a guardianship in the case where there are no funds. So that SDSC is already paying for that, though there isn't a procedure in place. And this would help to codify the procedure and when that allocation can be made. So their projected figures would indicate somewhere in the range of 500 new guardianships would or may arise out of this new legislation, where last year we had 50 contracts paid under these same circumstances, now suggesting a 1,000% fold increase to 500 is not realistic. So part of the budget is projected on that percentage of 50 last year of paid contracts, now correlating to 500 potential new guardianships being established in the state of Oregon for which they are projecting a fiscal impact based on that number. And I'm suggesting we're probably going to be closer to perhaps 50 to 100, maybe it might double. I anticipate that probably it would, but that's a far cry from the projected impact at 500. So currently they do have a procedure, though it's not formalized, in how they do pay for the establishment of guardianships in the event that they're not able to fund them through, you know, financial resources. And again, that number last year was approximately 50.
Any questions of Bruce Simon? Okay. Any further comment from our panel out there? No? No further testimony? Anyone else here wish to testify? No? Okay. One last opportunity for questions. Okay. Why don't you come up here and state your name for the record? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Mills. I'm with Senior Disabled Services Division, and I've been involved in analyzing this legislation for the division. When we tried to, when we first looked at this legislation, it was obvious to us that it was creating, in effect, a new subsidy for a service that we don't currently provide. Therefore, it was going to have a fiscal impact on our agency. The question was trying to determine as accurately as possible what that fiscal impact would be and to provide you folks with some real hard concrete numbers. The best numbers that we could come up with that were concrete and verifiable were the number of guardianships with the Public Guardian's Office in Multnomah County who are also Medicaid clients. We also know how many Medicaid clients we have in Multnomah County, and that's where we came up with that ratio of 0.6%. So in Multnomah County, 0.6% of all of our clients in Multnomah County have guardianships with the Public Guardian. That, of course, does not include those individuals who are Medicaid clients who have private guardians, family members, relatives, and so forth. We then took that percentage and we matched it against our total caseload of 86,000, approximately 86,000, and that's where the number 516 came up with. Now, you know, I can't sit here and tell you, you know, with 100% certainty that that's going to be the ultimate number of guardianships that we're going to be asked to, in effect, subsidize. That's the best number that I could give you. From an agency standpoint, our concern here is that whenever, it's a fundamental rule of economics, that whenever you subsidize a product or service, inevitably the demand for that service increases. And there is a general consensus in our agency that, if anything, we feel that 516 number may be a little bit conservative. But That's just a guess. As for the discrepancy between the 50 that we funded and the 560, we have to understand the process involved when we do pay for the establishment of guardianships. We do have a procedure that's limited to very certain specific circumstances where we will provide funds to an attorney pursuant to a contractual agreement that we have with those attorneys to set up the guardianship. We do not pay for the ongoing costs of those guardianships, and we very actively seek any alternative prior to using a guardianship. And that is something that we as an agency have control over. With those 50 guardianships, we are able to exert control as to when we're going to pay for them and when we're not going to pay for them. Unfortunately, with this legislation, we don't have that prerogative. When the guardianship is established is going to be pursuant to state law and pursuant to a judge's order, and so we would have no control in that particular set of circumstances, which is in part, I think, why we would expect the number of guardianships to be higher than the 50 that we paid for last year. And, I mean, if you look right now, as I said, we have 149 guardianships currently in Multnomah County. We ourselves paid for 50. That there alone is 200 guardianships right there. I am not clear from this legislation. It's not clear to me that, how do I phrase this? My esteemed colleagues are presenting that this legislation is going to be only in very specific, limited circumstances, and it's not exactly clear to me that that's the case. Maybe I haven't read the legislation correctly. Maybe I've missed something, but I am concerned that, in essence, what's going to happen is anybody who ends up with a guardianship who's a Medicaid client, the state, SDSD, in effect, is going to pay for that. Now, because whatever comes out of the client's income is income that isn't used to pay for the cost of care, which means that we have to pay for that care. So the hard part here is trying to figure out exactly what it's going to cost us, and we tried to give you some, like I say, some concrete verifiable numbers that to at least give you something to work with. One thing about the fiscal impact statement is, of course, we did it based upon the $75.10 figure, which was in the original legislation. And, of course, now there's amendment seeking to increase that to $200 or 25%. So the fiscal impact statement you're looking at, you do have to consider the possibility that there is that it may be higher because of that change. Exactly what we haven't really had a chance to try to analyze the effect of increasing it from 75 to 200, so I can't say with any certainty what sort of increase in fiscal impact that might present. With those comments, I would be happy to try to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Questions? Excuse me. Representative Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you agree that there exists a problem right now of people who have a medical necessity for the establishment of a guardianship but can't get one established?
I think there probably are circumstances where we have individuals who are clients of ours where the option to have a guardianship would be desirable, but we find it difficult and challenging to deal with sometimes. So I would have to concede that there may be some people out there that this is a real issue for.
Any idea on how many?
No, I'm sorry, Representative Ringo. I really wouldn't even begin to try to hazard a guess on that.
Okay, but you agree that this bill would at least allow people to create a guardianship, where otherwise they would have a difficulty creating a guardianship.
I would have to agree that there are certainly going to be circumstances where that would occur. I'm not sure that it's necessarily going to solve all the circumstances. If you have an individual whose income is very low, the amount of money that they have that can be diverted for the purpose of the guardianship may still be inadequate to actually pay the cost of preparing that guardianship. And since this really is simply a case of us replacing funds that are taken away, in that context, the fact that we're making up the difference wouldn't solve the problem.
I understand. Thank you.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. I'm trying to get at what it is that we're truly talking about. Are there a high percentage of these, for lack of a better word, indigent cases where the court waives filing fees, costs? They never do?
Madam Chair, Rep.
Let the record reflect.
you'll have to come to the mic.
Katie Blake, Madam Chair, Representative Lowe. The court has not been in the practice of waiving filing fees for indigents to date.
Madam Chair?
Representative Shetterly?
Well, maybe we just ask Mr. Swank about amending the law to provide for the court to waive filing fees. No, I'm kidding. that just gets his blood pressure going in the morning.
I have a little red color in the back of the room.
You know, I think there's good policy here. I think it's a question of who's subsidizing whom in some respects when you've got a situation like this. I understand that there's a dispute as to the fiscal, perhaps, unfortunately, and I've been in a situation before on these policy committees and not a member of Ways and Means. We don't have a lot of latitude there unless someone's going to go down to LFO and revise this fiscal that tells us that it's less than $50,000. I think it's a battle they're going to have to fight down in Ways and Means, but I'm sure inclined to go ahead and at least move this forward to the full to get down to Ways and Means and let the issues of the fiscal impact be wrangled over down there.
Any other questions? Okay. Anyone else wish to testify? Come forward, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Wright, and again, I'm here for the elder law section of the bar. There are only 2 points I'd like to add. One is, and we will provide the Judiciary Committee staff counsel. There, in other states, there actually have been cases in which the courts have found that regardless of whether or not a legislative action has been taken authorizing payment for such guardianships, it's required under the federal law, and we will provide that information, as I say, to counsel for consideration. And the second point I wanted to make slips my mind right now.
I've been there.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Dady Blake. I'd just like to make some comments following up to Mr. Mills' comments. First of all, as an attorney who works with families very closely in making this decision about guardianships, I want to assure you that this is generally not an elective process. They're faced with a situation where they're in an emergency. More often than not, their parent or loved one is in a psychiatric ward of a hospital or in another ward of a hospital or needs to be in some kind of care facility, usually without much control over their environment. The doctors are telling the family, we must do something. We only act and do this when we have to. You must make a showing to the court based on some pretty strong evidence that the person is not capable of making medical decisions for themselves adequately. Now, if there's another means, if there's a less restrictive means, we are required under law to take that avenue. It's not just the state of Oregon that wants us to do that. We all want to do that. And if there's an advance directive, a document authorizing someone else to make medical decisions for example, we often can do that, but we don't do this because we want to do this, and families certainly don't do this because they want to do this. I don't also think that this is a bill or an amendment that will give lawyers that do elder law more work. We have more work than we can do right now. We're not looking for any more. Notice whenever someone is receiving Medicaid will go to the state, so they will be informed and can, of course,
interject at any time in the court process. Finally, I would like to say, as an attorney who is one of the contract attorneys for the state of Oregon, that there are problems with that process. They are second-guessing medical decisions about when a guardianship is medically necessary. Excuse me. The other problem with it, I just got my contract renewal. The amount of cost that they will pay is up to $250. Well, in Multnomah County, the costs way exceed that. So essentially, if I sign the contract, I'm agreeing to pay approximately $750 out of my own pocket. Let's forget attorney fees every time I do one of these. So they're not adequately compensating attorneys. I suspect they'll have a hard time having anyone do these in the future, especially in Multnomah County with their new cost structure.
Gotcha.
And then the last point I'd like to say, when we are asking for fees, we are asked and reimbursement of costs under this amendment, it is coming out of the protected person's money. Yes, it does have a fiscal impact because it means that they have then less money to pay towards their care providers and the state will pick up more, but it is not coming directly out of the state's pocket. It is coming out of the very person who is being protected by the guardianship proceeding. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment. That highlights, I think, what I meant in the statement that I made, that it's an issue of question of who's subsidizing whom, really, in this whole process. So I'd like to get this down to Ways and Means. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, if I may, I remember my second point. And it is rather important because I don't want to raise a concern in the minds of the committee or have it on the record. The change from $75 a month to $200 a month and the percentage change, that does not have any impact on the total amount paid out, only on the speed at which the attorney who has advanced costs and time is compensated and the speed at which the amount necessary to actually achieve the necessary filing fee. It's speeded up, but it is not increased in size, so it should have no impact on the fiscal impact. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Okay. Hearing is closed. Work session.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I see we have dash one and dash two. As I understand, the dash two include the dash one amendments, so all we need is the one amendment. Then I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2364.
Any discussion? The objection? Representative Ringo, you have
Well, I'll just make a quick comment. Elder law is the kind of area in the law where there's a huge need and clients are looking for bleeding heart lawyers that will do the work at low cost and will subsidize. If this can help meet the needs, I'm very much in favor of it.
Thank you.
I have a comment.
Representative Lowe.
And that is very true. I set up a free clinic for seniors in my district years ago. You can't believe the crush of people that can't afford legal services and are trying to protect a spouse or something that's in dire straits. And there's really no place to send them. It's terrible.
Any further comments?
And...
Representative Lowe.
And it does open the fragile senior to abuse by predators out there. So that's a bad thing.
Any other comment? The motion is to pass the amendment. Okay. Any objection? Pass amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move House Bill 2364 as amended to the full committee. With a recommendation that the bill be forwarded to Ways and Means. However, we need to word that in the full.
Thank you. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay. Pass to full committee with recommendation to go to Ways and Means. Representative Shetterly, would you like to represent that at the committee?
You bet I will. Who's going to pay me to represent it? Yeah.
They will pass the hat here. Okay, 2365. Okay. Could you please read the summary, Council?
House Bill 2365 provides for continued validity of existing powers of attorney to ensure that a power of attorney that does not otherwise limit the period of its effectiveness shall remain in effect until revoked by the principal. And there is a fiscal impact statement on this.
That was just passed out this morning. Does everyone have that? Okay. No amendments. Just a How come you're not getting any?
I don't have fiscal.
I have fiscal, but I have no summary.
Mine says no revenue.
I'm sure.
Oh. I've looked.
I don't have a fiscal.
Filing system that's effective.
You are a genius. I wonder if
I figured it was me.
I wonder if I
could. Yeah, no, I should be one
here. That's okay. All right.
It's very brief. It doesn't give any numbers.
Oh, gosh.
Indeterminate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, sounds like people yeah. down there are getting grumpy. They probably are about now. We'll probably see more of these.
That's a good point.
Okay. I just like to state, Council just read the summary, but the fiscal statement that we are discussing up here, says the comments, the Judicial Department is unsure of the number of new legal actions this bill could create. Therefore, the effect on court operations workload of this measure is indeterminate. There are no numbers listed. So that's all the fiscal statement says. For those of us that don't have copies.
We're good.
Oh, you have it?
We're
okay.
We're back in business. Here.
We're back in business then. Okay. Okay, hearing. We are on the road, 2365. We've had our summary, and we have our panel. Who would like to begin? We have our same panelists before. Please again state your name.
My name is Dady Blake, Madam Chair. I am also a member of the Legislative Committee of the Elder Law Section, and I have been involved very closely with the Power of Attorney Legislative Subcommittee of the State Planning Section of the Bar as well. As you've heard by now, that our section is comprised of attorneys who specialize in legal problems, obviously enough, faced by the elderly in Oregon. And we use power as attorney quite often as an important tool to assist our clients in both protecting their independence as they age and giving them greater control over management of their resources. In case you don't know, a power of attorney is a written authorization where one person, usually called an agent or attorney in fact, is named to act on behalf of another person, and that person is usually called a principal or a grantor. The authorization is limited to the powers that are actually stated in the written document, and in Oregon, there is no specific form. Some states, like California, for example, have a specific form. Under ORS 127.005, the powers granted in Oregon under power of attorney are considered effective despite a later incapacity of the principal. We call that a durable power of attorney. And durable powers of attorney are really good things because they survive incapacity. The situation we've been talking about where a guardianship may be needed, for example, because it provides an informal and expensive alternative to protective proceedings and helps ensure that the principal's wishes regarding property and finances are followed. However, there's a problem, and that's why we're here today. There's a growing trend among banks and similar financial institutions to refuse to honor a durable power of attorney because they view the document as too old or what we often call stale to be any good.
Several banks are declaring even relatively young power of attorney documents as invalid. For example, in Bank of America in the Portland area will not accept a power of attorney document that's been executed over a year ago or longer. Well, that's, you know, that's pretty difficult for people to renew these documents every year, and generally they don't do it. They don't bear that expense, and it would be impractical to ask them to do it. The refusal to honor a power of attorney solely based on the passage of time particularly hard hits our elderly population. In the typical estate planning situation that we all deal with, whether it's a young person, middle-aged, or old, we draft a power of attorney for a rainy day when that person might not be able to act for himself. In that document, again, he directs who he wants to assist him and what ways he's authorizing another person to act for him. However, if the document becomes invalid simply based on the passage of time, by the time an elderly person needs others to act for him, his power of attorney is likely not to be valid. In that case, again, no one will have legal authority to act for him, and a guardianship or conservatorship may be required, and very importantly, his expressed wishes may be ignored. House Bill 2365 seeks to remedy this problem. The proposed amendment is a very modest one, aimed at allowing Oregon citizens to be able to rely on a power of attorney by discouraging the rejection of power of attorney documents merely based on the passage of time. It does this in two ways. First of all, it amends 127.005 to add the language that powers of attorney in fact, the powers of the attorney in fact or agent are unaffected by the passage of time. And then second, it authorizes either the principal or the agent to bring an action against any party that fails to recognize the power of attorney document simply based on the passage of time. One of the areas I specialize in as an elder law attorney is elder abuse law, and I need to recognize that in talking about this. I'm often called to be an expert witness, and I often pursue civil litigation for my elderly clients who have been financially exploited. In my experience, the lapse of time has not been a reliable indicator that a power of attorney document is invalid. And in fact, all the cases I have dealt with where there's been financial exploitation using a power of attorney document, the document had been executed close in time to the financial exploitation. And I could talk about why that is, but this is what happens out there. The elder law section is very well aware of the important role that banks and other financial institutions play in helping to safeguard against the misuse or abuse of power of attorney documents. We don't want to in any way curtail their ability to watch out for the interests of their clientele. That is why House Bill 2365 seeks only to prevent rejection of power of attorneys, which are based solely on the passage of time. We are confident that financial institutions that suspect abuse will not be hindered by this amendment, and that they will be able to find other reasons for rejecting a power of attorney. And the ones I've listed here are the typical ones that come up in actual financial exploitation: unusual size of transaction, unusual type of transaction, and other suspicious circumstances. All we're asking is that they don't solely base rejection on the fact that they're some period of time has passed since they were executed. With House Bill 2365, the elder law section hopes to achieve a balance between safeguarding and protecting Oregonians, at the same time providing Oregonians with an inexpensive, and flexible tool to control and manage their assets. Thank you very much.
Any questions of Ms. Blake? Representative Shetterly.
Great bill. I've run into this, and it's awfully frustrating. You know, you get your clients in, and they do their wills, they do their advance directive, they do their powers of attorney, and your typical clients naturally think, well, we're glad that's done. I'm never going back there again.
Absolutely.
So those things all go in the drawer, and it's not like a dentist where you come back every year as a matter of course. It usually took the clients 20 or 25 years to get in the first place, and now that it's done, they're not going back. And it's extremely frustrating then if this power of attorney needs to be exercised at some point in the future, to have the spouse or the children dig up the power of attorney and present it, and then have a title company or bank say, we're not going to accept this because it's too old. Well, the very reason
it's there was because they were planning in advance for these contingencies that did in fact occur. So I like that very much. One question I've had, though, I've run across a bank recently that has rejected a power of attorney simply because it was not on the bank's form. And I'm wondering if you have encountered that, and if that ought to be addressed, too, if the rejection is solely because the power of attorney is not on the form provided by the, I guess we have to work on that. But that's bothersome, too, because it's hard to anticipate in advance who all out there has their own forms that they require, or who between the time you've drafted the power of attorney may impose a policy that says we're only going to accept powers of attorney on our form. And that, again, is a real hurdle where you've done this planning, you thought you've got all the bases covered, and now you go to the bank and the person's incapacitated. That's why the power of attorney is being presented, to have the bank or other institution, I don't want to just pick on banks, say, well, we have a policy now that says that the power of attorney has to be on our form, has to be our language. Well, we don't have that in Oregon. We don't require any particular language. And it frustrates people who have done this planning to encounter rejection on that basis as well. I think that we ought to at least talk about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, I have experienced that exact... I'm sorry. My name is Ruth Simonis. I have experienced that exact problem, and what I have found that with additional cost to the client for my intervention, I've been able to contact the legal departments of the various banks or financial institutions and question them regarding their procedure, and what they're explaining to me is a failure to properly train their staff and branch members that it is not required, but somehow it gets miscommunicated that there's a preference for the bank forms, somehow making it a requirement. And so, unfortunately, it cost my client my attorney's fees to go and figure this out and have to enforce the appropriate use of the power of attorney, but they're citing improper training or lack of communication as a problem.
Any other question? Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because I'm curious, the bill allows a principal or attorney, in fact, to bring an action against any person. Could you give me some examples of an action in this case?
Madam Chair, and Representative Backlund, Dady Blake again. The most common action that we would see, and we are really very optimistic that actions would only need to be initiated and would soon go by the wayside. But, for example, a case... I've mentioned Bank of America. I've had a lot of problems with them dealing with older power of attorney documents. We would, if they continued to refuse to honor it and it needed to be used, we would bring a civil action under this amended bill to make them honor the power of attorney document and honor what the agent is trying to do on behalf of the principal. The power of attorney document allows the agent, to the extent that it's stated in the document, to stand in the shoes of the principal. For example, to write checks to pay the bills. That's usually the thing that we need to get done. And if the bank's not allowing someone to go in there and take over a checking account, you know, bills aren't getting paid. That might be hospital bills, care facility bills, whatever. And they need to get paid. So we might start an action. I feel very confident that they would go, oh, well, oops. You know, and that we wouldn't be doing this for very long, but that's what I would anticipate.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Ringo.
I was trying to whisper for my Representative Shetterly to answer this, but I guess I'll ask you.
You didn't like my answer.
I didn't like his answer. That's right. I'm wondering what the damages would be under the action, and some of the whispering is, well, maybe the damage would be to compel performance. Is that the type of damages we're talking about?
If I may, Madam Chair, my name is Jennifer Wright.
Thank you.
This bill did come out of Legislative Council's office in a slightly different form than it went in. And because of that, this wasn't an issue that the section or the committee has directly addressed, and it was raised to me by the Trial Court Administrator's office at the beginning of the hearing. Originally, we had not written it as a new form of action, but simply included an attorney's fees provision to say that if some action needs to be taken in the course of some other proceeding, the portion of those fees which are attributable to establishing the validity of the power of attorney should be paid by the institution that refused to accept it solely based on passage of time. So the question now is, it's drafted with as a new cause of action, whether or not it should be for injunctive relief only, which I think would solve 99% of our problems and would probably be very satisfactory. There will be, in some cases, however, be damages. And that was, you know, we were discussing this. It could be a situation where, a property was foreclosed upon because bills couldn't be paid, a business opportunity was missed, an ongoing commercial enterprise was basically halted in its tracks. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense where damages could be an important part to some people. I think that for us, if we could get as far as getting the injunctive relief, we'd be very happy. But it is true that there could be damages.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Ringman.
I'm just wondering whether that ought not to be clarified, because it's not clear to me. And maybe the absence of specificity means it could be either. But on the other hand, I think, as Representative Federley seemed to assume, we're talking about injunctive relief, and certainly there's possibilities where you could have monetary damages. Somebody might try to argue you could get non-economic damages, but I'm wondering whether we ought not to specify, and I guess what I would invite comment on that.
Any other question or comment?
Manager?
Yes, Representative Shirley.
I think that'd be worthwhile. Mm-hmm. You could just leave it as simple as bring an action for damages or injunctive relief or something.
Exactly.
Make it
exactly.
Leave it open like that.
I would support that kind of amendment.
And in that case, then we could, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, we were conversing by note about costs as well as attorney fees. I think those are generally recoverable, probably under the ORCP, but we want to make sure that those aren't omitted by lack of reference in this particular statute. And again, it may not be necessary. And then if we're going to do that, we can take consider whether or not we also would include in this the issue of refusal to acknowledge simply because it's not, on a particular institution's form.
Representative Lowe, almost said Shetterly.
Okay. We're interchangeable parts. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I also would suggest that we don't limit it to attorney's fees related to an action. I've had a similar case with this where I made a demand of a bank and they did actually pay the cost my client incurred to get them to see the light. So it was unusual.
That'll bring the bank.
It was a very good day for my client.
Any other question or comment for this panel? Representative Shetterly.
Just one. I would encourage in the course of amending here to perhaps, I think the farther we go, further we go with this, the more likely we will be hearing from Mr. Martinez and some of our bank friends who we love and respect. It may be... anticipating that, it may be worth bringing them into the conversation if you haven't, and perhaps I'm trying to think like we have in the statute that allows in non-probate estates to get funds out of an account based on an affidavit, when they're mm-hmm. $15,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some provision in the statute holding harmless banks or other, I guess anybody who relies on an apparently valid power of attorney to use, because I'm sure the banks are going to come back and say, well, this puts us between a rock and a hard place then when we have reason to believe that there's fraud or abuse going on or there's something, and now you're forcing us to choose, and it's a Hobbesian choice. We're going to get sued by somebody. We just don't know which side. And maybe some, contemplate perhaps in here some provision for to hold harmless a third party who relies on an apparently valid power of attorney, has no notice of any defects or something like that. And that may make this easier to settle on both sides.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
I mean, I don't think the banks are hanging out on this right now. I've never heard of the banks claiming that they're subject to that sort of choice. And my understanding is there are certain protections as far as validity of signatures and that they're seldom... They're seldom found to run into difficulty because of those. But maybe you have a different understanding.
Madam Chair, I'm just thinking that's why I say the further we go, if we're going to restrict them from the ability to decline based on the age of the document, which I think is sometimes used as a cover for other concerns, or the issue of the form, which also can be used as a way of not taking action. I think once we start limiting their ability to say no, then I think we need to consider some protection on the other side to hold them harmless, in fairness.
Thank you. Okay.
But besides, the bill has a better chance of passing if we include the banking in our conversation, so I agree with Representative Shetter.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and Representative Shetterly and Representative Lowe, Ryan Gibb, the elderly law section has not presented this in a sense of creating an action where we can go out and attack banks. ORS 127005 already makes a power of attorney durable, and by law that power of attorney is already durable, and the banks should, under Oregon law, rely on that document. The purpose of this bill, the limited purpose, really is to assure that a bank or financial institution or any other person is not going to deny that durability simply because they see that it was signed more than 90 days or more than a year ago. Thank you.
Okay, we have one other witness on this one. Thank you, panel. Appreciate it. Brad Swank.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank from the State Court Administrator's Office. I'd also like to introduce to my right Bruce Miller, who is new to our office and who's a legal analyst and a former civil litigator. And actually, we came over this morning to raise the exact issue that Representative Ringo had just raised, that this creates a civil action without explaining what the remedies might be. And since it's been raised, this gives me an opportunity to introduce Mr. Miller and to say that we are concerned and think probably the bill does need to address that issue. Otherwise, it would be litigated and conceivably go to the Supreme Court with people having to argue about what remedies were available. As I said, I brought Mr. Miller to speak to that issue, and he can answer any questions if you've got it. But Representative Ringo has also already raised it, so that was our issue. Okay. We haven't taken a position on the bill other than that, except to note the technical issue.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. Anyone have any questions of the gentleman? No? All right. Thank you very much. Okay. What we'll do is, in view of the suggested amendments to this bill regarding the additional refusal of the form and the damages and the hold harmless clauses that may be requested by the financial institutions, I would suggest that those individuals here get together with Representative Shetterly, perhaps. prepare these amendments, and it will take some time. Legislative Council's office is pretty well backed up, so we will reschedule it later with the amendments, get together with Andrea here and get the amendments set up and on the schedule. It'll probably be out 3 weeks, so Andrea Chartel will reschedule. Thank you.
House Bill 2366. Council 2366, hearing is open. Would Council please read the summary?
House Bill 2366 modifies the definition of financially incapable to allow certain Medicaid applicants and recipients to take advantage of federal supplemental needs trust provisions on the same basis as residents of other states. Thank you. There's no revenue or fiscal or amendments on this one. Thank you.
Okay, we have Ryan Gibb. Are you going to testify on this one as well? All right. Thank you. Jennifer Wright.
Madam Chair, Ruth Simons has carried the water on this one, and I'd like to defer to her.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, I have submitted testimony from Attorney Penny Davis, who has had 14, 18 years extensive experience in dealing with this particular statute and the creation of irrevocable trust for incapacitated persons under the ORS 125. What this particular bill will do is currently, if a person is incapacitated or disabled, they have ability to set up a special irrevocable trust that would enable them to receive supplemental benefits in addition to what is offered through SSI or Medicaid. And this would enable them to address the quality of life issues that would not otherwise be affordable under the state and federal programs. What we're trying to correct with this particular bill is that in a scenario where you have a client who is physically disabled but not otherwise mentally disabled and is still capable of handling their finances, if they don't have a parent or a guardian who can set up this irrevocable trust for them, they can't avail themselves of this avenue of resource. And I wanted to use an example here to demonstrate that. Say we have a young man, we'll call him Joe. He's 25 years old and he has cerebral palsy. He's on SSI and Medicaid. His mother has died, leaves him insurance policy. After the funeral expenses, those policy paid up, gives him $5,000. Well, because Joe is on SSI and Medicaid, that $5,000 kicks him right off benefits. Now, had his grandmother died and left him that same policy, his mother then could have set up a special irrevocable trust for him and be able to put that $5,000 into that trust, and he would still be able to maintain his benefits. So the whole purpose of this particular bill is to say, when there isn't a parent or guardian capable of setting this trust up for an incapacitated person who is not mentally incompetent or is able to handle their own finances, we allow the court to set it up to authorize and authorize the procedure, authorize the setting up of the special needs or supplemental needs trust so that they can take advantage of that benefit and those resources without kicking them off of their current state or federal subsidy. The primary definition here that we're focusing on is that the court can do this notwithstanding the fact that a person is financially capable. So before, a court could do this, but they were limited by having to find that the person was not able to manage their money as well as being physically handicapped. And so what we're attempting to say here is that a court does not need to find that a person is incapable of managing their money in order to be able to set this up and allow this person to take advantage of the opportunity to have a special needs or supplemental needs trust. So what we're talking about is a very narrow group of people or individuals here who don't have a parent, don't have a guardian, and are able to manage money, but are otherwise physically disabled. So to that target group, we're saying we're going to allow you, the court, to either enter a protective order or a special conservator to set one up, or be able to actually propose a trust and approve a trust for that party based on their own petition to the court. So, any questions, Ms. Simon?
No. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do want to just add one point, which is I believe there is a fiscal impact on this. At least we received it, and I just checked with Mr. Mills. It may be under the $50,000. I'm not sure. It's a small fiscal impact, but I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
I've been informed that it was probably determined to be too small of a fiscal impact, so we didn't get one. Thank you. Okay. Anyone else wish to testify on this bill, 2366? Please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rick Mills again with Senior Disabled Services Division. I don't know what the story is on the fiscal, but we did submit a fiscal, or at least I'm pretty sure we did. I know we prepared one. Whether it got to you or whether it got sidetracked because of the size, I don't know. But our best guess is that this will maybe add 6 cases to our caseload, and our fiscal projection on that for a biennium was $166,000, or $166,054. We used our average cost per month for a typical case, and so the fiscal will be relatively negligible.
Can I just let the committee know that what we've received from office is one of their statements that says depending on what happens with the sales tax.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. All right. Thank you.
If there's any questions?
Any questions of Mr. Milton? No?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right.
They should be able to give me an answer.
Well, here's that the full committee. You could have a vote.
Sure, I could have an answer whether or not it's, you know.
Okay.
Until July.
I think I'd like to move this to the full committee, and sure. Ms. Chartel says she could have a fiscal impact by the time this was reviewed at full committee, so I will close the hearing and move
information on that. I don't have any control over whether or not I'll have an impact.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2366 to the full committee.
Thank you. Any discussion? Any objection? House Bill 2366 is moved to full committee. And Ms. Chartel will schedule that when we have the fiscal statement ready. Okay.
For information that there is.
For information that there is not one. Correct.
And is there going to be a representative to carry that to the floor?
Oh. Okay. Representative Lowell will do that. House Bill 2367. Council, read the summary, please.
House Bill 2367 requires established guardians to provide intent to place notice to former attorneys of the protected person, the long-term care ombudsman, and or the Oregon Advocacy Center. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact. And we have no amendments.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. There is a dash one amendment.
No.
The next one. I'm sorry.
Okay. No dash one amendment?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Is there Catherine Belcher present? Thank you.
I had just received a statement, Catherine Belcher. Catherine Belcher is 23.
Madam Chair, Catherine Belcher is a member of our legislative committee of the other law section of the bar, and she's not present for oral testimony today.
Jennifer Wright, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. The proposal in House Bill 2367 addresses, again, I think a fairly minor change in the guardianship statute. In our last substantial rewrite of the statute in last session, maybe it was the session before last.
It was last session.
Okay. We created provision that required notice of intent to place a person in a long-term care facility if that intention was present at the time that the petition for guardianship over an adult person was filed. And the reason behind that was because this is often a key issue in a contested guardianship is whether or not someone should be placed in a nursing home. And there was not a great deal of opposition to this, as I recall. The issue came up after the prior session's enactment, where placement is made after, not at the time of petition, maybe not contemplated at the time of petition, but is subsequently required. It raises many of the same issues of autonomy and a great deal of concern on the part of our senior citizens about being involuntarily placed. Even people who have found to need been in need of a guardian still often have strong feelings about where they live and particularly about long-term care placement. Also, there was some concern that when the need to place was discovered suddenly and very, very shortly after the guardianship had been enacted, that perhaps there was evasion of the notice requirement at the time of petition going on in some cases. And so the proposal is to require that the notice that must be given at the time of petition to the long-term care ombudsman, to the Oregon Advocacy Center, which is the state-designated agency for advocacy for the mentally ill, and to the attorney who represented the person in the protective proceeding itself, should be provided when subsequent placement is anticipated. And that the intent is to give that protected person access, if necessary, to express their views and their feelings about this very major step. We've talked to quite a few people about this issue, attorneys, is this too onerous, and other, you know, other parties that may be affected, including the Ombudsman's Office and Oregon Advocacy Center, who I believe does have testimony today. And we have found a strong consensus that this would be a good thing and would be an additional protection at very little cost to the rights of our protected people. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Wright?
Madam Chair.
Representative Sugarley.
Thank you. I see it looks like we're correcting, among other things, an erroneous reference, cross-reference to a statute in this bill. That's a good thing. I have a question, though, as to the notification to any attorney who represented the protected person at any time during the protective proceeding. We have a similar requirement of notification in current law, ORS 125.060, regarding motions for termination of protective proceedings, for removal of a fiduciary, for modification of powers of or authority of a fiduciary, and others, and it includes a requirement that notice in that case go to any attorney who has represented the protected person in the proceeding. But also in that statute in sub 10, it says that the requirement that notice be served on an attorney does not impose any responsibility on the attorney who receives that notice, which I think is useful, because if you're in the file and 5 years ago and you filed a notice to withdraw, and you're going to get notice, and you're no longer the attorney of record, we need to clarify that, and, you know, okay, you've got the notice, but you don't have to file anything in response to that. Wouldn't we want to make the same provision in this requirement here, that so if we're going to require that any attorney who represented the protected person at any time during the proceeding, shouldn't we also clarify that this doesn't impose an obligation on an attorney who gets notice?
Madam Chair and Representative Sugarley, I don't have the statute in front of me. If it doesn't parse that way, yes, I agree that it should.
Yeah, it's confusing because there, under 060, there are notice requirements that include in the litany of proceedings or
yeah, within the guardianship, that in some cases, any attorney who's represented the protected person must be notified. And now we're adding that requirement under a different statute. And that part of current law that says the attorney that doesn't represent the protected person doesn't need to do anything about it doesn't seem to be incorporated in this new statutory requirement, so I think we should.
Any other question, Ms. Wright? Okay. Mr. Gibb, do you wish to testify at this time?
Thank you.
Teresa Miller. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Wright.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm here this morning representing the Oregon Advocacy Center, which is the organization identified in lines 25 through 27 of the bill as the system designated to protect and advocate the rights of individuals with developmental disabilities and individuals with mental illness as described in ORS 192-5171. The Oregon Advocacy Center is a nonprofit organization designated by the governor to receive federal funds in order to provide advocacy services to individuals with disabilities. I think Ms. Wright did a great job of going through mainly what our concerns from last session were. We see this as a bill to just sort of clarify what was intended last session. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions, Ms. Miller? Thank you very much. Okay. I would like to the amendment that was discussed here previously in regards to the clarifications in the proposed bill, if we could get that amendment prepared, and again, it would be about 3 weeks.
Andrea's got the language.
Andrea's got the language, okay.
If I can just interrupt, Madam Chair, what I would suggest is that since we're dealing with all the same people on all of these bills, if we could all just meet with me and Representative Shetterly at the end of the meeting. I've got my schedule set out for about 2 or 3 weeks right now, and so us with the LC backup, we'll get all the bills back on the same day in a couple of weeks.
Good. That'll work. All right. Thank you. Okay, 2367 is closed, 2368. Council, please read the summary. 2368 allows judicial review proceedings on advanced directives for health care petitions. This is the original wording of this bill was to allow advanced directives for health care petitions and petitions related to guardianship to be consolidated. There is a dash one amendment that consolidation is not the issue so much as allowing these two types of proceedings to be raised in a single proceeding initially. And so there is a dash one amendment. I don't have a fiscal impact statement on this.
It was, we just received this morning word from the legislative fiscal office. There's no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Okay, we have Jennifer Wright. Oh, we don't have Jennifer Wright. There you are.
I'm okay. Here. I would defer to Ruth Simons.
Thank you. Okay, please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ruth Simons, and as I mentioned, I'm a elder law practitioner in the Portland area. And what I seek to do, what we seek to do with this particular bill and the dash one amendment is to be able to hear issues pertaining to an Oregon advanced directive within a proceeding under 125, the protected proceeding, in which there is sought a guardianship or a temporary guardianship. And the purpose of this is because we're finding that many times the issues around the priority or the validity or the interpretation or application of a health care directive when trying to direct medical care on behalf of an incapacitated party sometimes, more often than not, raises the issue of guardianship and whether that should be pursued as well. For example, this comes up if you have a client who, in the process of estate planning, executes an advance directive, you know, 15 years later, forgets that he's done that, has executed another one, and the parties say, oh, no, I'm sorry, that second one, you didn't have capacity to do that, let's revoke that. So now you have warring powers of attorney. In the meantime, they say, well, fine, I'm going to go to court and pursue guardianship. So you have the same party, the same principal involved in both actions. So what we're seeking to do with this is say, if and when you are pursuing an action in a protected proceeding under 125, go ahead and bring the action, which were normally brought under 127, into this proceeding so we can resolve both issues dealing with the same principal when there is the pursuit or sought of guardianship for that principal. So it's in that limited setting that we would like to not have to go and file a petition under 127 and then seek to consolidate that under 125. So we're trying to save court costs and expenses and attorney's fees for that principal or incapacitated party since they're the one who bears the burden of the cost. So we'd like to go ahead and allow the initiation of that resolution of the advance directive controversy where a guardianship is sought as the matter of the protective proceeding. So it's a very limited application of introducing that particular statute.
Okay, thank you. Questions of Ms. Simonis? Done? Okay.
That was easy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gibb, do you wish to testify on this?
No, Madam Chair, I'll defer to you.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Close the hearing and move to the work session. Any questions? Discussion?
They'll suddenly have fallen silent.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2368 to the full with the amendments.
Yes, with the adopted amendments.
With the adopted amendments.
Oh, we have to adopt. Oh, we have to adopt the amendment first.
I move that we adopt the amendments. Sorry.
Okay, there is a motion to adopt the amendment to House Bill 2368.
The dash one.
The dash one.
There is only one. Any discussion? Any opposition? Motion?
Now, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2368 as amended to the full.
To full committee? Thank you, Ms. Representative Lowe. Any question? Discussion? Any opposition? Okay. Pass the full committee, House Bill 2368. Who would like to carry this one? Any volunteer?
It's Charlie's turn.
Charlie?
Carrying them to the full committee, is that it?
Yes.
Okay, I'll carry it.
Representative Ringo.
Vic skated today.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, if I could just take a minute, we didn't get a chance in the beginning. This is Marilee Harrell. She is an extern with our office, and I believe a third-year student at Willamette University, third-year law student. And she did all of the preparation and met with all the parties, all of the SMSs for this meeting, which was quite an undertaking. So. She's going to be continuing to do a few bills at a time. She's also available to do research projects or things like that that I might not be able to get to. So if you have those kind of projects, let me know. I've got all of her contact information. So,
Marilee, that was did an excellent job. Extremely comp-